Sports bettors, Circa Sports now presents Palm Saturdays with Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm. Live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Here on 104.3 The Score. And watch live on YouTube and Twitch. Featuring the latest and the greatest of the sports betting landscape from coast to coast, along with some great guests. Here he is, Mike Palm.
Good Saturday morning, Chicago. I'm live in downtown Las Vegas here at Bar Canada at the D. We're 58 degrees at 6 a.m. on our way to 77. You're 46 on the way to 56. Now, I know some of you may have gone to bed last night when the two-time defending world champion Los Angeles Dodgers were leading the Chicago Cubs 4-0. It looked like that nine-game win streak was coming to an end, but in came Dansby Swanson. Four RBIs. A double in the seventh, plates two, and a two-run homer off Tanner Scott breaks a 4-4 tie in the ninth. Caleb Martin closes the door, and the Cubs have now won 10 straight games, and they've got Colin Ray on the bump today, 3-0 against Rory Sasaki. Maybe the Cubs can make him cry on their way to an 11th straight win. We'll talk about that game later. Want to talk about the draft, the NFL draft, specifically the Bears' top two picks. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Of course, we've got the NBA playoffs first round fully in swing. The Lakers went up 3-0. They were plus $5 in that series on their way to maybe sweeping the Houston Rockets. And our Minnesota Timberwolves up 2-1 on Denver, and our Atlanta Hawks up 2-1 on the Knicks. At 6:25 my time, Darren Pang's going to join us. We'll talk to Panger about these first-round series in the NHL, and where have all the great Canadian goalies gone? It seems like a generation lost. Can we blame Sidney Crosby? Well, maybe. We'll hear what Darren has to say in about 20 minutes. But first, I want to start with the draft. You know, I said last week this year's draft didn't really have the buzz that we've had in probably the last five, well, post-pandemic, let's say that. It had the least buzz post-pandemic of any of these drafts, and maybe it's because we all knew Mendoza was going first. It wasn't a quarterback-heavy draft in that, you know, would Ty Simpson possibly go in the first round? That maybe there was a little drama there. There was movement around who was going to be the two pick, but not really a lot of buzz around it. Maybe I'm jaded by having it from a betting perspective here. Our handle was down year over year, but he still put on a great show in Pittsburgh, and there was plenty of drama and plenty to discuss about the draft in general. I'll get into more who are the winners and who are the losers next week when we've gone through the entire draft. But I did want to talk about the Bears because I thought the Bears got extremely fortunate by the Vikings' first-round pick. I thought that at 18, everything told me, and what was coming out of Minnesota, you know, that they were going secondary, they were going safety, and I was almost certain they were taking Dylan Tiedemann. But here's the problem in Minnesota. They don't have a general manager, right? They fired the general manager, and then they promoted the assistant general manager. It's clearly he's an interim. He's a figurehead. Kevin O'Connell's running the draft, right? But he's running the draft on the offensive side. And then Flores is running the draft on the defensive side. And they don't have a general manager who's trying to make a pick for the benefit of the organization. And I don't know if Flores is as good an evaluator of college talent as he is of pro talent. He clearly is a great evaluator of pro talent. But I was shocked that the Vikings at 18 would take Caleb Banks from Florida. This is a kid that broke his foot right before the combine. An oft-injured guy with a ton of potential. But if he's not healthy, what does that potential get you? I thought it was a big swing there for them and not taking Tiedemann. And lo and behold, here at 25 come the Bears needing a safety, and Tiedemann still on the board. And Ryan Poles went out and snatched him. Let's hear from Ryan Poles on the pick.
When we do our meetings, we go, we take the average of like the high grades from the fall, and we work, you know, from the top down. And when we started the safety position, there's a couple good ones that we liked. But Dylan's tape popped out, like just a sense of urgency that he plays with, the speed. We talk about taking the air, you know, out of the defense or out of the offense. His ability to close on the football, both in the run and the pass, stood out really, really quick. And as we watched it, the comments you could hear, I mean, this guy is obsessed with football, plays fast. He's extremely smart, great leader, violent in the way that he plays the game, everything that we're looking for. Then on top of that, you have some versatility. If he has to, he can go over and play a little bit of nickel. He can play free, he can play strong. So really good fit for what we're trying to do.
I'm sure plenty of you out there have watched him play. An Indiana kid, went to Purdue to start his career, and then, you know, he took a shot in the transfer portal with a team he probably thought he could win a national championship with in Oregon, or at least go to a playoff, and certainly they did. But he pops out on you at the screen at how much ground this kid covers from sideline to sideline and how versatile he is. So I think that's a home run. I would grade that pick in A. He was fortunate he was there, and the bidders didn't make a mistake. And then I wanted to go to their first pick, or their only pick of the second round. We'll save the third round for next week. But an Iowa kid from Council Bluffs went to Lincoln Central, the Remington Award, clearly the best center in the country. Not a weakness. You know, usually you say an offensive lineman, he's a great pass blocker, he's an average run blocker, he's a great run blocker, he's a below-average pass. This kid is great at both run blocking and pass blocking. He did not allow a sack last year in 25, but more than that, he didn't even allow a quarterback pressure, and Iowa not known to have the nimblest of quarterbacks. Logan Jones in the second round at 57. Let's hear from Ryan Poles again.
Logan Jones being the first one, a good opportunity to add another center. Obviously, that's been a tough position for us since I've been here, really. So we had an opportunity to bring Logan in, and high-character guy, really smart, fits our scheme in terms of being able to run mid-zone, wide-zone, strong, explosive, has great range, reach and cutoff. Really liked his tape, so it was a good addition there.
I love the pick as well. I mean, he'll be the heir apparent to Dahlman. He gives them some bench strength in that offensive line, some depth. And again, to Paul's point, he runs the scheme. He's used to running the scheme that the Bears run, what they run in that pro set with Kurt Ferentz at Iowa. Kurt Ferentz was an offensive line coach in the NFL on Hayden Fry's staff. He's had many opportunities to go back to the NFL. He's chosen that life to stay there in Iowa City and done very well for himself as well. So I think the Bears did a great job with the first two picks. Certainly very exciting now. A ton of picks on day three of the draft today. A few other party thoughts before we move on to the NBA. I just cannot understand the Simpson pick at 13 for the Rams. I mean, I get it. The kid took a chance. He came out. He didn't want to go to Miami. Miami was offering him, what, $6.25 million to get in the transfer portal. But he wanted, and I made fun of him, his legacy at Alabama, his legacy of, you know, 9-10 starts. Because he sat on the bench for 3 years. He couldn't beat out Jalen Milroe. Just remember that. But he took a shot. I really thought the Rams were trying to move up to get Love, the Notre Dame running back. Those are the only two bets I made on the draft, was Love top 10. And then when I heard all this, I Love top 5 that got there. And Love's position went from 10.5 to 8.5 to 5.5, meaning that was the point you had to bet over under if you were betting the draft. Would he go 10th or under, 11th or over? And then that moved down, 8th or under, 9th or over. And then finally, 5th or under, 6th or over. I thought the Rams were going to try to get Love. And that they were talking even to as high as the Cardinals at 3 because they thought the Cardinals might take him. And then they take Simpson. You're a team that just won a Super Bowl. I mean, and this is a win-now league. The window closes quickly, and we know Matt Stafford has a finite amount of time. It's a longer amount of time than you had asked me 2 years ago that he has. And then the other argument is, well, he's going to get groomed, and he will play in the league under Sean McVay, another of the great offensive play callers, quarterback coaches. I truly believe that when Matt Stafford rides off into the sunset, Sean McVay rides off into the announcing booth. I do. So I don't think that Sean McVay will ever coach the Rams when Simpson is the starting quarterback, not due to an injury and he had to come in. The guys that I trust at evaluating this stuff, and there's only a couple, three of them, all said he's a third-round talent. So to go at 13, boy, I don't see it. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but my gut reaction to this was a big miss, and I think the Vikings were the other big miss. I thought it was interesting. Mekhi Lemon fell all the way down to 20, and the Eagles jumped Pittsburgh, who was on the phone with him. Obviously, they had good intel what was going on there. This kid's terrific. Now, I wasn't at all these interviews that he had at the combine that he blew, I guess, and some teams took him totally off the board. The interviews were that bad. I'd love to have tape on this. This must be worse than Vince Young at the Wonderlic. But the kid, I watched the several games I watched USC play. I was blown away by what he catches everything. And I know he's not that big, 5'10 and a half, 5'11 maybe, but everything that was in his vicinity, that Iowa game, he didn't miss a catch. Anything that was thrown to him, he caught. So I think it's a good pick by the Eagles. I think they got a steal where they got him. Just a reminder, we're here up until 9 o'clock when Inside the Clubhouse will come on with Bruce Levine and David Haw, and I'll get you their featured guest here coming up shortly. Now, let's move to the NBA because it's a little bit exciting. We went out and we took a shot and took some long shot series prices in this NBA. And I'll be the first to tell you, I'm not an everyday NBA bettor. I don't watch the NBA. You can't watch everything. And I don't watch the NBA religiously. There could be 2 or 3 weeks go by I don't make a bet on the NBA. I do like to get involved at the playoff time because now you know everybody has to play. During the regular season, I have no idea who's load managing, who's taking the night off, who's going to come out because they have a hangnail. But in the NBA, you know they're going to give maximum effort in the playoffs, and so then you can try to handicap it. Feel very fortunate that Atlanta is up 2-1 over the Knicks. You know, the first game opened in New York, and New York got out to what it seemed like 6 to 8 point lead, and it just stayed in that same spot from mid-second quarter all the way to the end of the game. It was somewhere between 5 and 11 points the lead. Atlanta could never really make a serious run at them. So the Knicks hold serve in game one. Well, maybe Atlanta can steal one in game two. It's the same plot. The Knicks are up 6 to 10 points the whole game. And then Atlanta makes this run at them in the last 4 minutes and sneaks out of New York with a one-point victory. Now we move to Atlanta in game three. Atlanta controls most of the pace of play, but the Knicks take the lead in the last 4 minutes and had the lead in the last 40 seconds. Atlanta scores. Knicks have the final possession to win the game down one, and what happens? Brunson turns the ball over, something that we did talk about. His offensive efficiency numbers against Atlanta is second worst of anybody in the league in the last 2 years. And so we have a 2-1 lead. Now, very thin margin here, and I feel precarious. And it's interesting in these series prices, the Knicks are still favored, even though they've lost home court advantage here. They don't move as quickly as the NHL series prices do. The other one I wanted to talk about was Minnesota. Minnesota and Denver. And we just thought this series was mispriced. This Minnesota team's made the Western Conference Finals the last 2 years. They were built to beat Denver. Gobert is there to stop Joker, and that's what he's done. I mean, what's Joker, 5 of 21 from 3? Horrific. Shot under 25% from the field in Game 3. Denver wins Game 1. Minnesota steals the second game on the road, controlled that game, and then blew them out in Minneapolis in Game 3. It's interesting. I heard a quote from Kevin Harlan, who called Game 3. He said that's one of the loudest environments he's ever been in. You wouldn't think that about Minneapolis. I do think the Timberwolves are going to win this series. You know, McDaniels, he gave him bulletin board material, but you could see it even after Game 1 in the loss. He said after Game 2, but you could see it in Game 1, he said, we don't think that any of their players individually are great defenders, and we're going to just go at them. And I think that's been the case so far. You can attack and attack and attack the Nuggets. Now, Minnesota's going to be a dog all throughout the playoffs because they're probably going to have to face San Antonio if they can get through Denver. And then likely OKC waits on the other side. I mean, they're going to face a banged-up Lakers team that shockingly is up 3-0 on Houston. I saw that series close -610 for the Rockets. Horrific. Horrific first two games in L.A. All one-on-one basketball. No creativity on the offensive end of the court. I was really really disappointed in Udoka and how little they did to try to generate offense to get them back in those first two games. They should have won the game 3 last night and choked it off, and the Lakers win in overtime. We'll talk NHL with Darren Pang coming up here in about 10 minutes. How about the Chicago Cubs? We were all wringing our hands. The Cubs were under 500. Win one, lose one. Win one, lose one. Cade Horton's down. Everybody in the Central's got a winning record. We're up against it with the Cubs. What are we going to do? And lo and behold, I guess the Mets were a great elixir. I don't think the Cubs dominated the Mets in that series, but the Mets found ways to lose, and the Cubs took advantage of it in sweeping that series. And then here comes the town, the Phillies. They dominated the Phillies. Yeah, they blew the big lead in the Sanchez game, but came back and won it. I mean, it's nice when you know you're going to go out there and score 5, 6, 7 runs a night. And the guys that had slow starts are starting to come around. And we see guys like Colin Ray, who goes today. You know, he did this in Milwaukee. He's not going to pitch every fifth day for 5 months, but he can spell you in stents, and he goes out there and he gives you 5 innings. You know, it's all these key parts. Imanaga has had 3 great starts in a row after 2 shaky starts to start the season. And Tyone is what Tyone is, right? I said he's going to pitch 5 innings, maybe 6, and give up 3 or maybe 2. Yesterday was 5 and 4, slightly worse than what you would expect, but the Cubs rallied to win again, and I think they're finding out, Council is finding out what works in the bullpen for him. He certainly pushed all the right buttons in the Mets series, and then again last night pushed all the right buttons. So I think there's very good things here with the Cubs as long as these pitchers can sustain. Cabrera hasn't really had a bad start yet. The wind was howling out that day that he pitched against Sanchez, and the Cubs got 11 hits off Sanchez, who I bet for the Cy Young. That's 2 starts now, one in San Francisco where Sanchez gave up 9 hits, and then this game in Chicago where he gave up 11. So very positive things. I like the Cubs today. We'll get into that in the final segment. With our best bets, the price reflects the Dodgers are always usually $2 favorites at home. Today, not even $1.40 as Cubs money has come in since the overnight opener of $1.55 with the Dodgers. Down to +123 here. White Sox have won a couple in a row. You know what the bet's going to be on that game. That's an auto bet because they're playing the Nationals. Remember, I told you, week 1, bet the Nats over every game. It's hitting over 70% so far. And the total still every day, 8, 8.5. I would have thought these national totals would have moved to 9 by now. Went over again yesterday. You got 8.5 again today. I'd continue to bet it over. Doesn't matter where they play. Most of their games go over by the 5th inning. This team hits, but they don't have any kind of depth at pitching, whether it's in the starting rotation or in their bullpen. So now the Cubs, after the 10-game win streak, they find themselves suddenly tied atop the National League. Central with the Reds at 17-9. And every team has a winning record except Milwaukee sits at the bottom of the division there. So things are sort of flipped from where we thought they were going to be 2 weeks ago, but boy, is it fun times when the Cubs are on a heater. Oh, just a note, special NFL draft edition of Mully and Haw today from 9 to noon. Bruce Levine gets to take the day off. You deserve it, Bruce. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk to Chicago Blackhawks former goaltender and color commentator. It's Darren Pang up next on Palm Saturdays here on The Score.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be with no bet fees on 104.3 The Score.
Welcome back into Palm Saturdays here on The Score, and it's our pleasure to welcome in via the Circus Sports Hotline, Circus Sports Illinois, betting the way it should be, our good friend Darren Pang. Darren, thank you for taking some time with us this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It's a nice off day here in Boston, so before I head out to the skates, this is perfect. Talk a little hockey. Love that.
Before we get into the playoffs and some macro issues in the NHL, I would like to talk about the Blackhawks. And, you know, you do the color for the Blackhawks game, so you witnessed this firsthand. You haven't won a series since the 2015 Stanley Cup Finals, have not won a playoff series. And you know, for a Blackhawk fan watching San Jose make a run at the playoffs this year, Anaheim, who's leading Edmonton 2-1, Philadelphia, who's leading Pittsburgh 3-0 with all these turnarounds this year and resurgence. What message can you give the Blackhawks fans that they need to be patient as this team seems to inch its way better each year?
Well, as we all know, rebuilding from the bottom is an incredibly tough task. It just is. I mean, you can ask, you can ask Anaheim, San Jose, Detroit. You know, it's just, it's hard to get the prospects that you have, which the Hawks have so many really, really high-end prospects, to win in a man's league. It's a league that's very difficult to learn on the fly. It's a league that's relentless and unforgiving, bud. And that's all I can say is that I see great spurts with the Hawks. This year was a very, for me anyway, between the benches, there were many games where I'm like, man, this team is not far away. And then there were many games where I said, this team is further away than I thought. You know, if that's a fair way of saying it. So they're disappointed as much as you're disappointed that they're not there, because I think they felt like they were beating or close in very close games against very good teams and felt like they were closer to getting into the playoffs than they were being away from the playoffs. So all I can say to the fans is it's not something you snap your fingers and you wiggle your nose, bud. It's like Buffalo, 14 years in Buffalo, and all of a sudden these guys got it this year. You know, they didn't have it last year. They didn't have it the year before, and they have an older group than we have in Chicago. And then the light went on this year, and it was midway through the year, and it was like, wow, now they became men right in front of our eyes. So when that moment comes, I think the Blackhawks are going to be dangerous for a long period of time. But until that happens, and until they learn how to, you know, win tight games and how to close out tight games, then that's when we'll be preaching patience until that time.
Let's go to Buffalo, since that's where you'll be calling the game tomorrow, Game 4, Boston and Buffalo. The only coach of the 16 in the NHL playoffs this year to make the goaltending change was Lindy Ruff, going away from Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen and to Alex Lyon. Were you at all surprised by that move and your thoughts on Game 4 tomorrow?
Yeah, no. Number one, I was surprised until I talked to Lindy and Ukko-Pekka, because I thought, keep him in the net for Game 3. It's not a defining moment in the series. It's Game 3. And then if it doesn't work out or you see or feel like he's struggling in Game 3, you can pull him then, and then you've got Alex Lyon the rest of the way. But after talking to Ukko-Pekka, who, by the way, if you've never met this guy, he's an unbelievable person. He's a really he's just like he's as real as the day is 24 hours. And I said, Ukko-Pekka, are you a little surprised that he made the change? And he said, no, we've been doing this all year long. And that's when I realized, you know what, the whole team wasn't bothered by the change, because they really have used all three goalies. Colton Ellis was picked up on waivers from St. Louis. He won some big games down the stretch. Alex Lyon won some big games when Ukko-Pekka was injured, and Ukko-Pekka won some big games. So I guess, personally, I was surprised until I got in their locker room and talked to their coaches and talked to their players and found out that they're the least surprised of it all.
Darren, let's go all the way across the country and the continent, I guess, to the Pacific Division. I'll ask you this question. Which underdog in the Pacific Division leading their series 2-1 is more likely to win it? Is it the Utah Mammoth over the Vegas Golden Knights, or is it Joel Quenneville's Anaheim Ducks over the Edmonton Oilers?
I think it's Anaheim's. I think that, to me, has really caught me by surprise. Anaheim's, I don't know why I'm not as surprised with Utah, because the Golden Knights have shown these signs during the year before they made the coaching change. They've had a good spurt since the coaching change, but I don't think they're a real fast team. And I don't think they're a real, I'm not sure if they're got that edge to them. And Utah has got that youthful enthusiasm right now that like, just like what we were talking about being a non-playoff team. I mean, the Arizona Coyotes haven't been in the playoffs for a long time. They haven't won a series since 12 or something like that. So, I mean, there's another organization that are happy to see them get in the playoffs, and they're due to get in. So the other side of it is Anaheim. And then, you know, to win 7-4 like they are, Like, that is, that's classic Joel Quenneville right there. I mean, I haven't felt like Anaheim's defended well all year long, but they're very resilient and they're having a lot of fun. And I think a lot of that has to do with their coaching staff led by Joel. So I guess I'm more surprised of the scores of the Ducks over the Oilers than I am of the scores of Utah over Golden Knights.
I'm gonna, one more question about Edmonton here, Darren. I have a sneaking feeling that we're going to see Chris Knobloch put Picard in the net for Game 4. Your thoughts?
Oh, that's, yeah. He's running out of some options right now. Calvin, oh my goodness, they've got their hands full right now. That's for sure. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. No, it wouldn't surprise me whatsoever. They've done it before, and he's an energy guy, so. Right now, they need a spark right there. Listen, they made that trade. They got Tristan Jarry. It didn't work out. Hasn't really worked out for either team, for Pittsburgh or for them. So then, when you think of what the Blackhawks did and got an ace goaltender in that trade with Florida, you go, "Wow!" Like that's the kind of trade that turns around an organization. And you know, that's one thing that the Oilers have not had for an awful long time is a top shelf goaltender like we have with Spencer Knight.
We're talking to Darren Pang, former NHL goaltender for the Chicago Blackhawks and one of the best in the business at color commentary. We take a question from a listener each week for our guest, Darren, and we got a bunch this week, and here's the one I chose. Darren, once the playoff starts, the spotlight of a number one goalie can be the backbone of a team all season, and then suddenly after one bad allowed goal in a playoff game, he's pulled or even benched. Take us inside the locker room, like after a goalie gives up a bad goal that cost the team a critical playoff game. How do teammates react publicly versus privately? And from the goalie's perspective, what's going through his mind moving forward when everyone is now openly or privately questioning you?
Good question. I like the fact that the question was in the locker room, privately and then publicly. Number one, if you're a really good team that care about each other, then honestly, my answer would be these players have all made mistakes before. Bad goals go in all the time. And, you know, they definitely care about how you feel. They care about what people say about you, and they protect you. If you're a team that isn't going anywhere fast because the players have got other agendas and they don't really care about you, well, then they throw you under the bus to their buddies and they say things to the media. And next thing you know, everybody's talking about how bad that goal is. But I just know that the Buffalo Sabres goaltender Ukko Pekka gave up a really bad goal. I talked to him about it. It was a flip that went in and he's like, I don't know. It just hit on edge and went in the net. Like, and I said, don't worry about it, Ukko. I gave up one from center ice in Boston Garden one time in 1987 or 88 with the Blackhawks. And he said, what did they do? And I said, all my players came back and patted me on the pad and said, keep your head up. We'll go get them. And that's what you hope that your teammates do for you when you give up a bad goal. Because, listen, every player makes a bad play almost on every shift. Every player turns the puck over on a shift. Every player, you know, makes a bad pass. It just happens or doesn't have their coverage. It's just that the goaltender is the last line of defense and we're the ones that have the magnifying glass on us. But for every time a teammate of mine made a bad play, jeepers, that would have happened a lot as well. So all you do is you tell them to shake it off, we got you, and pick it up a notch. That's kind of the best speech I can give anybody that gives up a bad goal or makes a bad play.
I want to ask you, Panger, about a move that wasn't talked about a lot when it happened right at the end of the regular season, but the Canucks fired their general manager, Patrick Alvin. And I thought, it's just my opinion that it's really kind of a raw shake for him. I mean, he isn't the one that decided to trade Quinn Hughes. Only Jim Rutherford could have made that decision or hire, right, to actually pull off that trade. He isn't the one that wouldn't take the option on Rick Tocchet and said, no, we want 5 years or nothing because we don't want you looking somewhere else. That's Jim Rutherford. And now the scapegoat for them having the worst record in the NHL is Patrick Alvin. Your thoughts about the situation in Vancouver?
Yeah, and I'm not really overly tight with that situation to, you know, to really break it down. And I do feel for what you just said, and I think a lot of hockey people feel the same way. you know, that that's a tough spot to be in if you're the general manager, but you're really not making all the calls as the general manager. And people have said that publicly. I don't know if that's, you know, confirmed inside their offices. I think we're all speculating that, you know, that everything was run by Jim. And if that is the case, then boy, that's a tough one for Patrick for sure. I've liked being around him. I think they had a good thing going when Rick Tocchet was the head coach. Rick Tocchet makes hard decisions. He certainly didn't like the drama between JT Miller and Elias Pettersson. You know, there was just drama every single time they turned around. So, you know, once Rick was gone, I think a lot of their culture and hardness was gone as well. And therefore, it looked to me like Jim Rutherford and Patrick, you know, decided just to move some parts, as they did with JT Miller, then they did with Hughes, and they couldn't get rid of Pettersson because of his contract, I'm sure. So now you've got this situation where it looks like Jimmy's, you know, back running it. But I'm gonna answer this in another way, and I'm not going around it, but I don't work for them, and I don't really know as much about it, so that's why I'm not giving you a kind of a hard answer on it. But you know, I will say this: that a lot of general managers in the league, that's one of the reasons why they don't like a president of hockey operations above the general manager. Because if you're the general manager, you're the one working every day. You're the one on the phones. You're the one making trades. You're the one scouting. You're in the trenches, and you got your work boots on. And then all of a sudden, a director of hockey operations or a senior advisor has the power to go, bang, okay, you're done. And therefore, that's why a lot of GMs don't want to get in situations where there's somebody above them like that.
Panger, I'm a firm believer that the sound has as much to do with the quality of a broadcast as the picture, and maybe in hockey more so than any other sport. I bet hockey every day, and I watch a lot of hockey, and I choose, you know, you have two feeds to listen to. So you choose the booth that you want to listen to, and mm-hmm. You know, I love Randy Hahn in San Jose and Joe B in Washington, and I think that booth in Vancouver is really – maybe it's underrated in large parts of the U.S., but to real hockey people, it's not. You worked for a lot of years with John Kelly in St. Louis. His dad was the first voice of the organization. Mm-hmm. I want you to play devil's advocate here and help me understand how the Blues can move on from John Kelly. I applaud the Kings for making the move to bring him there, and he's doing some games for ESPN in the playoffs. But play the devil's advocate here. How long-term, is that a good move for an organization?
Yeah, that was a much-talked-about situation, obviously. And it happened so late in the season. It was so unfair to John Kelly. Normally, you end up not being able to get a job because it's almost August when that happened and they decided to simulcast. So I was shocked. Shocked because I'm a longtime friend of John's. Shocked because I think he's excellent at what he does. Shocked because he's an ultimate pro. He doesn't stir the pot at all. He goes in, he does his work. He's a real professional. And so the LA Kings were lucky to grab him. A lot of people went to bat for John in LA. A lot of people made phone calls, which I'm not even sure if he needed at the end of the day, because his reputation precedes him as an excellent broadcaster. So I think you're speaking like a lot of fans in St. Louis and how disappointed they were in that. And every time I hear John Kelly's voice and I hear him call some ESPN games, obviously, and hear him call the LA Kings games with Jimmy Fox, I say, that's a great voice and that's a guy that can call hockey. So I'm with you all the way on your sentiment about that, and how they did that in St. Louis was not understandable. How about that? Not one bit.
Thank you for all the time. I'm going to take you out of here with one last question. I was thinking about the Canadian goaltenders, their Olympic goaltenders this year, right? And you know, Bennington played very well in the Olympics, and we know he's a big game goaltender, very well in the Four Nations. But you know, the two worst goaltenders statistically in the NHL this year, of those that started the season as the number one goaltender, were Bennington and Bobrovsky. Kemper's team got to the playoffs. I know he was injured, but, you know, Forsberg's playing great for the Kings, and he's their guy right now. And mm-hmm. Logan Thompson had a good year but couldn't get that team to the playoffs. What happened to this generation of great Canadian goaltenders, right? Is it Sidney Crosby? Did all the kids grow up wanting to be Sidney Crosby, and the kids in Canada didn't want to be goalies? And the second part of this question is, are you going to say to me in 5 to 10 years, say, Mike, that was a silly question because Joe Hofer and Jet Greaves are the top two goaltenders in the NHL?
Yeah, I like that you went down this trail because, you know, were Canadians wanting to be goaltenders because of Patrick Waugh? Did we have a great run of French Canadians because of that? And then Marc-Andre Fleury and Marty Brodeur. Or did the position of goaltending get some fun taken out of it? Is that it? Because one of the things that I've seen is the goaltending coaches that are there have gotten so methodical in the way they're teaching the game that if a goaltender had a lot of athletic ability, like let's say Pekka Rinne, and he was growing up in Canada and he was catching pucks and poke checking and all over the place, is that athlete maybe being shunted a little bit by some of the philosophies of these goalie coaches? And most of them didn't play in the NHL. Most of them have run goalie camps and goalie clinics, and they're good at what they do. But maybe some of the fun has been taken away. Maybe some of the flamboyancy has been taken away. And so you might be corrected. Sidney Crosby and Nathan MacKinnon and, I mean, Connor Bedard. Like, these kids grow up and they watch these guys on highlight reels, and they watch them make these unbelievable passes and east-west stuff and breakaways. And with the rules that have changed since 05, no center ice. A lot more ticky-tack calls that end up on the power play. Face-off ends up in the offensive zone for every power play. I mean, if you're a kid growing up, what's the dream? Be Patrick Kane or be Connor Bedard, because that looks like a whole heck of a lot more fun than being a goalie. So thankfully, other countries aren't doing the same thing, because we're still getting good goaltenders from Finland, from Russia, from Sweden, and the U.S., by the way. They've done a great job of developing top-notch goaltenders. So we got to pick it up in Canada. That's all I know, because we're not doing a good enough job there in my home country. And they've got to do a better job of developing goaltenders and getting them in the net. And then, you know, and hopefully we can get better at this, because it's not good enough.
Panger, we really appreciate all the time this morning. Thank you. And we look forward to the call of the game in Boston tomorrow. When we come back, we'll wrap up the show with my best bets for the day. It's Palm Saturdays here on The Score.
We're back with more Palm Saturdays, starring Circa's Vice President of Operations, Mike Palm, live from Bar Canada at the D from downtown Las Vegas. Presented by Circa Sports. Sports betting the way it should be, with no bet fees, on 104.3 The Score.
Welcome back into Palm Saturdays. We're taking you right up till 9 o'clock with a special edition of Mully and Haw, breaking down Day 3 of the NFL draft. Thanks to Darren Pang. That was a terrific 18 minutes that he gave us. Ah, hell, it's his day off in Boston, though. He had some time, but we appreciate him. Some tough questions on maybe some sensitive subjects, but of course, Pang very open and educated in his opinions, and interesting his thoughts on Anaheim and their chances against the Edmonton Oilers. Okay, let's go to our best bets for the day. We'll start in baseball. I tipped off a couple of them. I'm not going against this Cubs freight train right now. They're doing all the right things, but more than that, it's Rory Sasaki, who I can't take my eyes off of, because two hits in a row and you know he's going to cry again. This guy is not, I'm sorry, he's got a lot of talent. They tried him in the bullpen. Now he's starting again for the Dodgers. He's so very fragile. Colin Ray's been terrific. I'll take the Cubs as a dog here today. Plus 123 at Circa. I see plus 128 in the market in Illinois, so we'll take that best price. An auto over in the Nationals games. Nats and White Sox will play the White Sox over. That White Sox over last week, and we went 3-0 in baseball, by the way. That was not bad. Cubs, White Sox, and the Nats over the other game. The White Sox Oakland flew over. That was Severino, remember, last Saturday. I think they ended up with 13 or 15 runs in that game. So we'll play over 8.5 minus $1.12. In that game. I'm going to give you another over here, and it's an over because it's two pitchers that have lost a lot of velocity. I don't necessarily love these teams as offensive juggernauts, but let's go with Twins and Rays. Bailey Ober I mean, Bailey Ober's lost 4 miles an hour off his fastball. And, you know, I watch him pitch now. It's changeup, changeup, changeup. Well, the changeup only works if you don't have a solid fastball. If you can't throw 94, the changeup's only good the first time through the order. Watch Ober today. Watch the second time the Rays come through the order against him. And then this is a guy he talked about in McClanahan about how he was down 3 miles, 4 miles an hour in spring training. He's come back from the injury. You know, he's had some control issues. You saw him a game against the Cubs. For Cubs fans, you saw him pitch down there at the Trop. Wasn't sharp. Total here is 8. I don't like betting in that ballpark, but look, I think there's two solid reasons here to play this over. So over 8 in this game, minus 110. Okay, let's now switch over to hockey. We've been playing first period unders other than two series. I've stayed away from it in two series. I stayed away from it in Dallas, Minnesota, because, listen, Minnesota has two defensemen that think they're forwards, all right, in Faber and Hughes. So it's very hard for me to play those, even though a couple of them went under. I'm not playing under 1.5 there. And then this Anaheim-Edmonton. They should make it 3, the first period totals. Anyhow, stay away from those two and then pick your spots. So I'm going to play those two series today that don't have those four teams in them. Hurricanes-Senators, chance for the Canes to close it out here. Senators, unbelievably, couldn't get a shot on goal in a 5-on-3 power play. Travis Green is worried about the officiating and the bad hits, and his team can't get a shot on goal 5-on-3. Really disappointing. I think that's the most disappointing team performance, even more so than Pittsburgh. More so than Pittsburgh, who plays that roller derby kind of hockey. You know, 38 of their 41 wins, they've scored 4 or more goals. They don't win low-scoring games, which you need to be able to do in the playoffs. But the Senators not putting any pressure on the Hurricanes. And Stutzlin, game 2. Not only did he have like 6 scoring opportunities that he didn't convert, he had the horrific pass that led to the second goal for the Hurricanes. All of that is a long-about way of saying we're playing the first period under in that game. Under 1.5, and you have to lay minus 108 there. And then, so the Stars Wild, which is the game I'm most interested in this afternoon, but we're going to stay off that game. We have futures on the Wild. Penguins Flyers again. Tockett, you heard Darren Pang talk about how good Rick Tockett is in culture. I think tactically, he's been far superior to Dan Muse. Who'd have figured? In this series, and has been able to stand up Pittsburgh as they try to bring the puck across the blue line. And there's been no answer from Muse at all. And so I'm going to play the first period. And Vladar's been very good. I'm going to play the first period under 1.5 here as well. That's an even money bet, plus $1 under on the first period in that game. When we turn our attention to the NBA games today, I look as almost a matter of principle at the Thunder and the Suns. The Thunder, what were they, 18.5, 19 the other night? Did not come close to covering. Now, of course, that number drops, and it drops off the performance because, you know, it's not a 10-point difference from home to road, but it drops off the teams may have been. I look here at this game, Thunder-Suns, and it's 9. If you can find a 5 in the first half out there on the Suns, I would play that number. I'm not playing 4, 4.5. I want a 5. I need the Thunder to be up 6 to beat me in that spot. Look, I'm invested, and I don't usually double down on teams when I make a series bet. But I'm going to do it today with the T-Wolves. I'm ultra impressed with the way they're defending, with the way Gobert is putting the Joker in a mixer down there and in a blender. And look, Joker's going to keep putting the shots up, even when because he's the leader and he's still the best player in basketball. But you can get him shooting at 30%, you've got a huge advantage, and that crowd will be fired up again, just like they were last year in that series against the Lakers. So we're going to play again at a plus price, the Timberwolves plus 2 today. We hope you enjoyed the show. Enjoy the draft coverage with Mully and Haw up next, and we'll see you next Saturday morning here on 104.3 The Score.